welcome. Thank you for calling, tuning in. Thank you for tuning in to the call sheet. I'm Keith Coogan. God, so glad I could fucking remember my name. Keith Coogan, welcome to our live show here in downtown Los Angeles. We're at SkidRowStudios.com. Thank you, Jeff Fiorentino, for a great theme music. That's Earthshaker by Jeff Fiorentino. You can find tracks, how to play our theme song at jfrocks.com. He's also got some rockin' Christmas tunes. It demystifies the guitar. So if you ever, you know, want to learn how to play the guitar, go to jfrocks.com. And thanks, Jeff. Good to talk to you the other day. We are joined here tonight by my dear play act sister from, God, let's see, 1978, 79. So it's been gobs of years, 36 years.
Oh, gosh, we're not that old.
Yeah, we are. We are that old.
No.
Yeah, we are that old. And we look damn good, too.
Yes, we do.
We are two good-looking
former child stars. And they have to believe us because there's no cameras to show that we're...
I'm such a narcissist, but I'm like, every once in a while, I'll be like, damn, all right, I look pretty good for my age.
So some things never change, huh?
Stop it. No, you look great. You look great. Whatever you're doing with your life, you know, however you're living, where. I mean, Southern California, we know there's a secret sauce in the air that keeps you looking young and pretty.
I'm on the other side of the orange curtain, so it's all good down there.
Now, that's, I spent some time down there, and I don't think I'm allowed to go back, so that's okay.
Disneyland kicked you out?
Chapman. Me and the 22 have an issue.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. How do you like it living down there?
You know, I mean, even when I was on the show, I was driving from Orange County.
Right.
I grew up there. So I love it. And I don't realize that there's such a difference between LA County and Orange County until I come back and I'm like, wow, this is really different. And it really hit me. We went to go see our friend play at a club. And we're sitting there. It's Valentine's Day. My husband and I are on a date listening to our friend play. And then Nate looks at me and he goes, oh, I get it, red, Valentine's Day. And I'm like, what, people in LA don't wear red for Valentine's Day?
They're so jaded.
So I stuck
out. They'll wear costumes on every day by Halloween.
I didn't have hearts on my sweater, but I had on red. Yeah, so yes, in Orange County, we do wear green on St. Patty's and red for Valentine's.
You guys have time to put flags up on Flag Day and do the whole thing.
You know.
Manicured lawns.
It's because we have a little less traffic.
It's safe and there's a little more space. And
actually, people aren't really manicuring their lawns these days. Not me, but the turf is very new in Orange County where it's a little too green.
Is it still growing? Are they still building out? And is Orange County still like pushing into the hills and empty lands? And
yeah, they're all the, you know, during the election, they were trying to stop them from encroaching upon parks. And I mean, we'd like to keep that, some of that nice, fresh space, but it's tough, you know, because people are still moving down because Orange County is desirable.
It is. Is it, I'm going to be so politically incorrect. Is it racially mixed or is it a damn white county?
We are not that white where I live. Yeah. Actually, not at all.
Okay.
No, when we were looking at our kids' school, I liked the fact that it was totally mixed.
Okay.
And I mean, but there are areas that are pretty strong pockets, but it might be a strong pocket of Asian community or a strong pocket of white. And then you have your blend. And I like the blend. Where we live, it's the blend.
Are joined by our producer, Jeremy. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Thanks for coming down. Hey. What a good man. He's so responsible for building this studio out and creating this great space for us to do our shows and welcoming to whatever we try. He does. He's like, that's great. I love it, man.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Very, very cool. It's so good to see you again. Now, you were here, like, you were one of my first guests.
I was your first guest.
You were my first guest.
Yeah.
That was so cool. Thank you for doing that, too.
Oh, my gosh. Of course.
Kicking it off strong.
I mean, it's not like we have the privilege of seeing each other that much. So whenever we see one another, it's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I remember the first time I saw you after I hadn't seen you since doing the show. And when we left the show, we didn't know we weren't coming back. And so we said goodbye and thinking we'd see one another in July. And then we didn't see one another until the Youth and Film Awards. And I remember being 15 and breaking down crying for seeing my brother. And you were like too cool and probably 11. You're like, just uncomfortable. And I'm like, my brother.
You'd had the day's experience and you were used to like sticking with something for a while. That was new to me to work longer than 2-3 weeks on something.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd really never sat and done a series. I had done 6 weeks maybe on this Hawaii series for ABC.
And it was somewhat the same way with Days of Our Lives, because when I was on Days for 3 years, I was supposed to be gone for 3 months and then I was supposed to come back. And at that time they fired all the writers and the game plan was totally changed. The new writers didn't rewrite Janice Horton back in as me. So that was like, I lost that family. And then a year later I lose my Walton family, and you know, it was a little emotional. Junior high, going back to junior high was emotional. And my escape was to go back to the Waltons, and then the doors were closed and no more room to say goodnight, Serena.
Good night, Grandpa. Jeffrey, you still got that chicken? No, sir. It's cool. That was really part
that
cool
was
to be
our
part of the goodnight
one.
Stuff. So we'd stand in the kitchen and we'd loop the goodnights.
Absolutely. It was like a checkered tablecloth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was some of the fun things. There were a lot of fun things on that show, though. Like, we had our garden. Do you remember that we planted a garden?
Was it right by the house, or was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, where we drove the car through.
Yeah,
eventually became our garden. And we had our fish tanks where we'd adopt a fish.
We were going to jet out of town, right? We were taking the car and we were like, out of here. We're like, screw these Waltons folks. Let's hit the road, man.
Oh my
gosh.
We
made it 20 feet.
You know, I was driving at 13. It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And you were smoking at 10.
Smoking and yeah. Yeah. But you were a pathological liar, a kleptomaniac. I was a pyromaniac.
Yeah.
Just general bad liar and a sass talker.
Yeah.
That's my favorite part, was talking shit to Ralph Waite.
The most embarrassing thing was when my mother-in-law goes, oh, I just taped this episode of You on the Waltons. Everybody come around. And it's this scene where I was stuffing my bra.
Yeah.
I'm like, hello. And there's my daughter.
Wait, did you order the little box and in it is just tissues? Or was it you were just stuffing your bra?
No, I was fully stuffed. And I probably had something I stole from Mary Ellen.
Yeah.
You know.
Brooches went missing when you were around. That was, and you know, God rest her soul, but our great aunt.
Peggy Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was an amazing woman.
Workhorse, man. She's on so many shows.
She was on I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
And then.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
We came on in this little unit from the kinfolk. From the kinfolk on. And every once in a while, I'll be switching, and all of a sudden, I'll see the horse race episode, or I'll see the soapbox derby episode.
What was my favorite, though? What do you think was my favorite?
Was your favorite?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have no idea. The movie star one? Which one? What was your favorite?
So where I was getting my Girl Scout badge for first aid, and I got to tie you up and gag
you. Favorite. God.
That was the best.
Yeah, no. Last time you gave me plenty of, and you reminded me what brat and attention whore I was as a small child. I mean, because usually in school there's 30 other kids to get attention from. So if you annoy someone for a minute, you can just turn your chair and start annoying somebody else. But I got to
hear
guys by the second or third episode, you guys were done with me.
No, because I wouldn't have cried at the Youth and Film Awards if I was done with you.
Now, I found our Halloween newspaper that we put out. I have a copy. Do you have a copy?
I don't know if I do.
I have a copy. And we signed everything KM or MN or KC or, a D, whatever. Like, whoever was in school, we would sign our stories with just our initials. And we had poems and stories. We did a whole thing on the Phantom, which was the ghost that's going through the studios, and we each wrote a different part of the Phantom.
Right.
And I was reading your poems and stuff, and I was like trying to read into them, like, what's, you know, seeing, is there, is she saying anything in here or whatever? It was just beautiful stuff. You were very mature and very good command of language. We put a crossword puzzle in there. and like doodles and jokes and quotes from the set. It was a really neat, like mimeograph too. We would like make it, and then we had this orange cover, and we passed it out to the cast and crew.
It was our TMZ. See it.
Yeah, I'll get it for you.
Do you remember that there's two incidents right around Halloween that I remember that in the sister's home, we built the maze. Mm-hmm. And the other one was you, me, and Cammie went to a haunted house.
That was great. We went out to some haunted house.
Who knows where?
Whittier or something like that. And it was this huge mansion house and the lines out the block. And they're all paying $20 or $25 or whatever at the time to get into this. And it was before like haunted houses became really popular today. Now the Fright Night and Halloween scare and Universal and all that stuff was going on. And we got to be in the mannequin room. dressed up on the checkerboard floor with the strobe lights going, thank God we didn't have epilepsy.
And we were like holding a card and still, and it was either to you or to me or to both of us. I remember these girls coming through and they're like, oh, this is so easy. This one's real. This one's not. This one's fake. And she touches one of us. And she lost it. And I'm like, yes, we need an Oscar for this performance.
Yeah, we were hot, sweaty mess too, because it was like it was just all screams and fun. I think we did like an hour or two in this
house.
It
wasn't really that long, but oh my gosh, it was fun to just stand so still and think people that they thought we were mannequins.
Mm-hmm. And it was a nice break from doing the show too, and it was like we get to do this other kind of fun thing because we're on the show. We got to be in this thing.
Was it because of that, or because we were in mime together too?
We were in Vicky mime Shepherds? Together, yes.
And you were better than me in that, too.
No, BS. I got to go on KCET or whatever when they did the telethon. And they were like, okay, you're going to do mime. And I'm like, cool. I had this whole bit with like a jail cell and, you know, getting out of the jail or something like that. And I'm preparing. It's going to be like a 3-minute bit. They tell me you're going to have 3 minutes to do your bit. And I'm all ready to go. And I'm just about to go on. And they go, by the way, we cut it to 1 minute. Go. And so I did the trash can with the banana peel and pushing the trash.
I just remember you did the box and she's like, perfect. Now, Martha, could you do it a little bit different? I'm like, I couldn't do it.
The stairs, walking against the wind, walking the dog, the box, the rope. I still love the rope. I do that stuff all the time. I still do mime.
And see, because you were better than me, I gave up.
My mom also forced tap dance on me around that time. Probably just prior. Yeah, about 8 years old, it was tap dance. And I remember one day outside of the tap dance studio, I lost my skateboard down the gutter. It like went and he went right down one of those gutters in the Pacific Palisades and boom, clatter, clatter, clatter into the little thing. So my mom calls my dad, D, to come out, and D pries open the manhole cover, climbs down there and grabs my skateboard and brings it back.
That's very D.
Yeah. Oh, D is fixed. The door fixed. I'm all over it. The car, I'm all over it. He can fix anything mechanical. People he had problems with, but I love him dearly. He's got a gear, a sprocket. I could fix that. He'd compete with my grandfather, with Jackie. He would compete with, because Jackie would want to do it himself and didn't like this guy with his daughter and stuff like that. And he'd come and spend summers with us in like 3 months with Jackie. He'd get bored and want to like build a fence in the backyard or something like that. And he would. My stepdad, D, would do like get the wood and dye it perfect, you know, like a redwood stain. Everything's cut to the millimeter and like, you know, absolutely beautiful, beautiful work, and posts with cement in them and everything. My grandfather built one out of like thin slats and chicken wire and like painted it badly with like redwood stain. And so this whole beautiful fence and backyard, and we built a little mini, there was this little stairs that went up to like the quarter acre, but we didn't want the dogs to get up there. So that's why Jack was building the fence to keep our dogs from going up there. So all this beautiful work and then Jack's fence. And it was just kind of funny. We just had to let him do it, you know. Go, Jack. Okay. But I remember Jack would always yell for him. And they'd be in a separate part of the house with their own little kitchenette and bedroom and bathroom and stuff. But if he needed something fixed or something broke, you'd just hear, OD from across the house. So great.
Oh my goodness. It was really in our formidable years that we were together.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you were at my 18th birthday party. You had a broken arm.
At Flippers?
That was 13.
Oh, that was 13. Where was the... Oh, at 18th birthday.
It was someplace with huge steps
the Palace Hotel or the Plaza Hotel right off of the park down on Wilshire. Was that it? Like the big
think
steps?
Possibly.
I think
yeah.
That's it. Yeah. They would rent out those rooms.
Yeah. You came.
I had a broken arm.
You did
I
looked have,
cool in that cast, though.
And you had a nice, thin black tie.
Of course.
You know.
Parachute
pants.
You were
rocking it.
Yeah, and like a pink Miller's Outpost shirt.
Miller's Outpost.
I lived in Miller's Outpost. Thank you for tuning in to Remembering the Late 70s with Keith Coogan and Martha Nix Wade. Those were great times. And I did, you know, I'd work before and after the Waltons and... that's a great memory for me because it's the longest that I'd ever worked on one character or one thing. My mom says that she noticed that I'd gotten burned out on it. After just a year, she's like, you were done with the show. So I think that's why I don't remember the Youth and Film Awards of like being upset or the show's canceled. It was like, I mean, you know, you go on and you work and you do other things and stuff. And I was always scrambling to get on another series. I was dying to, you know, get on the show. But nothing was like that. It was all sitcoms. There was nothing that hour drama kind of show. There was like Family. Remember Family?
Yeah.
With Quinn Cummings.
Quinn Cummings. Wow. Yeah.
You were mentioning names earlier, like Shannon Doherty and Melora Hardin.
Danielle Brisbois.
Now she's talented.
She's got a beautiful voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember listening to Kelly Clarkson's first album. I'm like, man, that backup's great. Start looking through it. I'm like, you are kidding me. This is Danielle.
I mean, she was on All in the Family, and that was like respect. I mean.
Well, we were on it twice together.
Are you kidding me?
No.
How cool is that?
It was. Norman Carol O'Connor was awesome. Lear.
Wow. Of course. Of course.
You know,
I watch the show now, and I realize how hard he really worked.
Oh, absolutely. And then it went on to become Archie Bunker's Place. Mm-hmm. It was a great show to work on. And Carol was an amazing guy. And Danielle was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We had a lot of fun on the show. And then we do like fashion shows for muscular dystrophy or this. And we'd show up at these random fundraisers together and have contact over the years. And then, you know, I moved on to my life in Orange County and, you know, lost contact with most everyone. And so it's odd to have this childhood one specific way and then your life to completely change.
Well, I mean, everybody grows up and you in school, you have tons of stuff to be. I'm a football player. I'm in the band. I'm in the chess club. I'm, you know, great at home, whatever it is in school, you know. Then you grow up and you go to school, to college and stuff, and you make choices and it's like all your interests when you were a kid and stuff. That's rarely what you really do. Ours was, I don't know, similar to that. It was just another kind of out of school extracurricular activity that we did that millions of people happen to watch.
But it has a unique, if you will, high to it. There's nothing that duplicates really that feeling of going onto a set. It's an amazing feeling. And then to be on a show for any long period of time and have that experience. I mean, part of it is it's work. You know, like people say, oh, do you watch yourself? And you're like, no. Because like a surgeon doesn't necessarily go and watch the video of him doing a replacement of this or that. It's his job.
Yeah, but he does have the patient come in after 6 weeks to kind of check everything. Oh, that looks good. It's healing nicely. That's okay. I guess that was good work I did. It's okay to watch your work.
Oh, I don't. That's awkward.
I had kind of problems with it until I was watching some of the Waltons, and especially when I was a kid. Because as a kid, it was kind of hit and miss. And, you know, I would get some parts that were like crying roles and stuff like that. Sometimes bad kids. And mostly I was just kind of a brat and, you know, kind of funny and not too like integral. I wasn't like a Ricky Schroeder. I wasn't a River Phoenix. But
you were very good, Keith.
When I watched the Waltons, I was actually proud of the work. I was like, you know what? For 8 or 9 years old, I was like, all right, pat myself on the back a little bit there.
You should.
Yeah, I've been socked in the face enough by this universe. It's okay to have a little little pat on the back.
And everybody talked about how fabulous you were, and they still do.
Oh, I was okay.
Okay, don't take a compliment.
You were great. You were very heavy on the show, too. And then I was too. I just didn't feel it. At the time, I was, like, acting. I mean, I was doing my little kind of shtick and pouting a lot and, like, brooding. Picking up chickens.
Picking up chickens. And burning down buildings.
Had to burn that shit down. Killing the dog. That was fun, too.
You didn't kill the dog.
I chased Reckless off into the woods. He was going to go die anyway. So that's the one episode I am pretty disappointed in because they had to do the glycerin and I couldn't cry.
Oh.
And we're by the old the Fantasy Island waterfall area mm-hmm. in the back. And I just couldn't pull it out of me. I was having too much fun. I was having too much fun in the show. There was no conflict. There was no like strife.
See, I couldn't eat the mincemeat. Yeah. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I do remember that one.
I couldn't do it.
I couldn't do it.
No, I got it up and I'm just like, God, please, God. I wanted to vomit.
I loved all the fake food in the kitchen, the fake ham, the fake stuff. I'd play with all that stuff, the balsa wood, the fake barbed wire up by the barn.
But weren't the mashed potatoes real?
Oh, when we ate?
Yeah.
Whatever, I don't. I mean, they put food in front of us that I'm pretty sure wouldn't kill us. But, you know, we're always just kind of pushing it around. And I said this last time. That was a lesson in how to shoot 15 people in one dinner scene. It's amazing. It's amazing. They're like, all right, raking 5 shot down this side of the table.
Yeah.
And little John Curtis. And oh, God.
Amazing. I wish you could have been at the reunion.
I know.
It was pretty crazy to see all of us as adults. It's
but
random.
Don't they have the same exact spirit? Don't they have the same? It's them. It's the same people.
But the ones that are weird are the little kids, like John Curtis and...
The ones that are weird.
I mean, they were like 2, and now they're however old. You're like, oh, you're an adult. Like, because we haven't really changed that much, but we have.
No, you haven't. You look like you looked... I mean, it's you. You know, I can tell. And you're cute. Other cast members of the Waltons, they grew up and, you know, they grew up. They do look like their character, but, you know, if they weren't on the show and you didn't know and you ran them on the street, you'd be like, okay, they're interesting looking. You're gorgeous. Look at that smile, too. And you got your...
I paid him beforehand.
Great fingernails.
They're blue.
Painted blue.
Okay, Keith, over. Tell everybody why they're blue.
They're blue because you have a great nonprofit foundation called A Quarter Blue.
Exactly.
And I did last April, I did paint one fingernail blue.
And that's what men should do.
Yeah, of the 4 fingers, so one is a quarter blue. I was talking to some friends about your work just this week because it was coming up. And I was telling, you know, they're like, what's the show coming up? And I'm like, oh, Martha's going to come back on and we're going to talk about Quarter Blue. And I talked about the stat, a quarter of the children, you know, are sexually victimized in this country at some point. And one goes, oh, no, it's 1 out of 3. It's just interesting that sometimes I get different reactions. Sometimes we go, really? I didn't know that there was that much, you know, 1 out of 4. But then some people, and I know that they had to have had, you know, some issues in the past because they were like, no, it's 1 out of 3.
Right.
I'm like, okay, you sound pretty strong and firm about that. What happened, you know?
Exactly. Well, and it's one of the statistics that we'll absolutely never know. Actually, the most commonly used statistic is 1 out of 4 girls and 1 out of 7 boys. I personally believe there's no difference between male and female.
No, never get caught with a dead girl or a live boy, I think is in politics what you're supposed to be careful.
All righty.
Yeah, well, it's more of a stigma for men, especially if they were assaulted by men. Because there's a homosexuality angle and like, am I gay now? Because, you know, this older man touched me.
Right.
What does that mean? So there's probably less. I didn't tell my mom until my uncle passed and I was 21. And of course she completely denied it. She's like, no, you're lying. Why are you making stuff up like that?
Right.
I told my grandma and she's like, I know. I'm like, what? She's like, I know. It runs in the family. I'm like, what? Wait, you didn't tell or warn? Well, he didn't know and... What? And I was thinking about this and I've been in issues. My father has passed a month and a half ago.
Oh, I didn't know.
Jeff, my birth father, he was 62 and died of cancer. He advocated for the reform of marijuana laws and stuff like that. And he died the day before the elections and he lived in Boulder, Colorado. He died the day before they legalized recreational use for it. And he fought all his life for this. He was this hippie activist kind of guy, libertarian candidate for like local city council and stuff like that. My mom and him, 3 months old when they separated. And Dee came into our lives the day my mom left my father. She goes over to girlfriend's house and her girlfriend's boy, you know, boyfriend, best friend is D.
Oh,
who
wow.
watched me on the set and drove us down.
He did. He was there all the time.
Yeah. I asked my mom to be on the show. I said, Mom, it would be great if you came on and like, we're like the stage mom and tell us the point of view of a mom. And she goes, I wasn't a typical stage mom. I would drop you off and leave.
She did, but she was there too.
Yeah. She'd always suss it out. And if everyone was safe and it was good and she knew the director and stuff, she'd be like, all right, I'm cool. And go do her thing. Sign me out to Glenn or something like that.
We had a great teacher, Glenn.
Uh-huh. I had a lot of good teachers. Lewis, I don't remember Lewis. He was Arnold's on Different Strokes. He was his teacher. Always with him. There's a few that I really, really enjoyed. And you'd work with the same ones.
Right, you would
see. Over and over again, you'd see them and you'd be like, oh, great, I love this one. She's got great, you know, games to play or, you know, extra books and stuff to go through. Or I liked how they taught you.
Well, and you were, I mean, still are, you were very intelligent. So they had to be on top of their game with you to keep you on task. And because you do your work and you're like, okay, what's
done.
Next?
I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I chewed through, I went back and I was grades ahead.
Oh, absolutely. You yeah. were then. You were in class with, I mean, I was in 7th grade. Cammy was probably in 10th.
I was in 4th.
Yeah. And you were, occasionally Glenn would 3rd. Just pass over our work.
Yeah, that's right. I did 3rd at Webster Elementary in Malibu, did the Waltons. And then since we moved to Trancas Malibu West, I went to Juan Cabrillo for 4th grade. But I came in what was it, April, May, June, or whatever. I came in...
February.
Oh, okay. So, I'd come into school, you know, after that we'd finished the season and already, you know, most of the school or half of the school year had gone by when I went into school. And I was, nope, you're wrong, teacher. Nope. That's, you know, and little man Tate, where they're like, how many of these numbers can be divided by 2? And Tate's like, all of them. I was that kid.
Yes,
I was,
you
like,
were.
Jumping ahead to decimals and fractions and all that shit. And history, this isn't the way I taught it. There's another way. There's a trick. If you do that and move the 0 to do that. Because I learned all this stuff from each of these different teachers. And that's, I really love that. I love the one-on-one instruction. And that it was only 3 hours a day.
Well, and people think that, oh, it's only 3 hours. But what we could accomplish in 3 hours was pretty miraculous.
How about in 20 minutes? Remember, you couldn't
yes.
do shorter than a 20-minute chunk. But they're like, they got some time left? Yeah, we're setting up. How long? 15, 20. All right, send the kids to school.
Exactly.
We'd run off and do like 3 questions on a test. And right. then run back to set.
We'd do 20 minute. Or we'd just... We had a day where we weren't working and we just put in all these hours of work so we'd get them in the next, you know, however many days we didn't do school.
Yeah. Well, we had to do 1. By law, we had to do 1, but we could bank up to 2 a day. So we could work 5 hours on school, bank 2, and the next day work 1 school and use the 2 banked hours.
But there we have it.
But yeah. But were there days that we just didn't even do the 1? You're keeping your lip zipped on that one, aren't you?
But you know what? I think we loved being in that room so much. I'm sure Glenn wrote off many a time we were in there feeding fish, writing the newspaper.
Oh, totally.
You know, so we were in there because we loved being there. And I'm sure he marked that as school. And I'm sitting here saying, oh, some days we didn't do school. Oh, wait, I guess that was.
We spent time in there. Just spending time in there was school.
Because it was a learning experience,
anywhere,
but
and
it
there was a toy, a microscope, a something, you know, sulfuric acid, all the chemicals that he had.
Oh, my gosh.
A full chemistry set.
It was half of our schoolroom.
Yeah.
And but see, I was always amazed at what animals he'd go capture out of the Pacific Ocean and bring back. And then we're like, where's the octopus? We can't find the octopus. And it crawled out somewhere and we never ever found the octopus. And then didn't we have like a crab war and one crab killed another?
No, it molted and we thought that it was 2 crabs, but it had shed its shell and then was on the other side of the tank. Pretty funny.
Oh my goodness.
So that was, I was 8. That's the time when my uncle started molesting me. I figured I was talking to my friend Sky the other night and she was like, well, what were the periods of years? And I was like 8 to 13, I think about 5 years.
And so mine was probably 7 to 13. So we were being molested at the same time.
Yeah. And I have further discovery because it's like I've started to churn up memories and stuff like that. And I remember at first it was innocent kids and how do you masturbate? And how do you know? It's like I would lay on my back and like rub my legs together and my little pee-pee would be in there. And I was like, that tingles, that feels good. And my uncle would be like, well, look, you can use your hand and do this. And I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, and my friend who was like very open about it. And I don't, you know, if she understands kind of the crime that it is. She goes, isn't that just kids and experimenting? And isn't that healthy? And I'm like... not when it turns into threats and then it turns into bribery, because that was another thing. I got done with it. By the time I was 10 or 11, I was like, I didn't like going over to Palm Springs anymore. I didn't like, go, oh, he's there. Fuck. I got to sleep in his room and I got to deal with this again. And so it got to the point where I was like, no, I don't want to do this. And he goes, well, all right, any toy, whichever toy do you want? And he had this one big Vegas, like with the roulette and the felt and the like dice and cards and everything like that. I'm like, that, I want that toy. It was like a $35 toy or something. And he goes, okay, that's yours after. And so I'd have to jack him off and then after I would get the toy.
Right.
But I love that fucking thing. And it was instantly gone out of my mind what I had to do to get it. And I had it. I was like, I mean, it worked. His tactic worked.
Well, we were kids, and one, we wanted someone to pay attention to us. We wanted to, because we were working kids especially, when someone would spend time to hang out with us and play, it was fun. And then to do something for a reward was part of our work and therefore became part of our experience as being molested. I would have to do certain things. A director told me to do this. I'd do it. It was my job. My perpetrator would ask me to do something. I'd do it. It was my job to be an obedient little girl. Period. End of story. Don't question adults. And that's who I was as a child before acting. It was who I was as an actress. And so it's who I was as a victim.
Since he was 2 years older than me, my uncle, it was like an older brother situation, but it wasn't. He's my uncle. And he was the one that would mete out punishment through my mom. She beat him. Oh, he didn't pick up the dog shit. All right, for every pile that you find, you can sock him in the arm. And he thrived on that punishment, that control, that power. He used to pin me down and put his knees on my arms and like typewriter on the chest or like, smother me with a pillow. I remember that. He used to smother me and stuff. Like if I didn't make the bed, he'd be like, you're not leaving this room. No, you're not. I'd be fighting and kicking. This is all during and, after the molestation had happened. At one point he reached an age, and my friend Sky was like, is he gay? Did he move on? Did he molest other kids? And I went, I didn't think about that. I remember a shower situation. We had a pool. My grandfather had like a separate, because he snored like a bastard. So he slept like 700 feet from my grandma in his own den room, kind of a thing, like the garage converted. And in that other side of the house was a shower, but it was like an open, you like walk in from the pool and there's just a huge, you turn on the thing, the whole bathroom was like tile and made for it. So I do remember three of us. I don't know who the third kid was, but I remember my uncle showing this other kid the game that we had played standing
right
there. And it was a flashback. I had never remembered that. I had suppressed it. But when she asked me that, it was like it triggered this memory. It was really weird, and I don't think so. And he went on to find girls. He was very Italian stallion, like very macho, had a family. After his daughter was about 2 years old was when he reconnected with me. We had dinner, and he said, Keith, I'm sorry. And we had a moment there, and I was like, you're forgiven. We were kids. And I forget, and thank you for that, because I needed to hear that, and I needed to know that you knew. And
right,
he did, and he died a week later. A motorcycle accident. But I think it was him having a family that he's like, oh, I have a daughter now. Okay, I get it. So he got it. And there was no excuses. There was no buts or ifs or well, because it was just, I'm sorry. So needed to hear that. And I'm sorry that you didn't get to really have that. You had well, but her fault. You had a different kind of a thing, denial, right?
He's never apologized.
I'm sorry.
Oh, you know what? For me, I think
I'm apologizing for you. See what a victim I am?
I accept it. Okay. No, I'm okay. No, it's a matter of...
Martha Nix is breaking down in front of us right now.
No. We confronted him. And I said to him, I said, I forgive you. He said, oh, you forgive me. You forgive me. Thank you. You forgive me. And I said, wait. Forgiveness means I'm releasing you. You are no longer my issue. I am cutting the ties between the two of it. It's between you and your maker. And you have a choice. You can deal with that here on earth because he was in the room. He knows exactly what you did. Or you can deal with it when you die and you're face to face with them. Your choice. But as for you and me, I forgive you. I release you. Now, he didn't say, man, you're right. I'm sorry I fill in the blank. That was it. And in later years, he was in our church.
Yeah, and it's funny you said meet you. That's between you and your maker.
Right.
It's funny that there's this social circle, the church, that he's a part of, or is he influential in, or just a member of? Or
no,
was he
seriously influential?
That's fucking wrong.
Right, absolutely. But what a perfect place to be.
My uncle was a altar boy.
Mm-hmm.
Like the robes, the candles. And I remember this is around, I was probably 10 or 11, so he was like 12 or 13. And I've always thought about that. I was like, did someone in the church do something to my uncle, Chris? And then he did something to me. I don't know. I've always thought about that. He never talked to me or anything like that.
And
I'm sorry, I was raised Catholic, lapsed Catholic. So I apologize to the Catholic Church, but hey, it fucking happens. We have documentation.
No,
so I always thought about that as this.
Well, the church is the perfect place, no matter whether it be church, synagogue, temple, to really prey upon families, because really they're preying upon families. They're not solely preying upon a child. They're looking at the family structure and they're saying, where can I get away with this?
How did it affect your parents? Because you were telling me you're getting some recent breakthroughs. You changed or been doing some more work with the parents of survivors.
This November, we started a parent support group. And we also started a therapeutic art workshop. And we're just watching amazing transformations in people. With the parent support group, they are so hungry to have people who understand what they're going through. Because where do you turn with this? Who do you talk to about this? Because there's unfortunately such a stigma upon it.
And you could turn to us, 1-800-893-9562. We are live right now out of downtown LA on the call sheet, skidrowstudios.com. If you have a question for Martha, founder of A Quarter Blue, we're also joined by
Wayne Brazell.
Wayne Brazell, who is your...
He's a board member.
Board member.
And he's amazing. He's a psychotherapist and has amazing insights. And his wife, who passed away 3 years ago, was one of my board members also. She is a survivor of sexual abuse also.
I see him nodding and shaking his head and like agreeing when he hears certain things that we're talking about throughout the hour. And he's got a great smile there.
And he can chime
love.
In.
There's so much love right there. This man is supporting a really, really great cause, something that's not talked about, something that's taboo.
And it shouldn't
be. On mainstream media, on television. I could watch Fox News, I could watch CNN, MSNBC for thousands of hours, and maybe 5 minutes out of those thousands of hours may even try to swerve near it and then run away fast.
And that's the problem, they run away, and that's why parents feel as if they have no place to turn, and victims feel as if they have no place to turn. And we are trying to stop that.
Wouldn't more information and more, like they always do these things like signs your kid's on drugs and he's red eyes and his schoolwork's failing and he's disinterested in shit and he's like, not you know, and he's all of a sudden moody and stuff like that. That's it. The kid's on drugs. Is there tools or things that you're teaching parents? And would it something that you would outreach to people that haven't yet necessarily discovered or known? Are there ways that people could know or tools and dialogue they could use with their children? Like in Traffic, his daughter, Michael Douglas' daughter, gets busted for smoking crack or whatever, or heroin. And the other senator is like, well, have you talked to your daughter about what drugs she's done? And he's like, no, he'd never had the conversation.
Right. And it's believed that 95% of sexual abuse is preventable through education. And my niece is also a victim of the same perpetrator.
It'd be great if it was like 1/32nd blue.
Oh.
Wouldn't it be great if it was like 1/99th blue? Wouldn't it be great if it was zero blue?
I'm ready to change my name, you know? And there's a way too. If we had these conversations in which we're having right now to say, okay, we were both victims of sexual abuse, but here we are. We are functioning adults who are trying to have an impact on our world and teach out of our own personal experience. Ways in which our parents possibly parented with flaws that led us to be victims of sexual abuse. For example, if your grandma knew
that
it was in your family.
I felt that my father, that if he hadn't, quote, abandoned me at 3 months old, maybe he would have been spending time with me instead of my uncle.
Right.
And, well, and there's blame there. I'm like, I kind of blame him. He's gone now. I can't talk to him about that. I don't lay it on him or anything like that. But I had a weird feeling the other night where I was like, I'm mad at my father because if he was there, he would have stopped this. He would have rescued me from this.
It's possible. At the same time, usually perpetrators are so sly that the average person is going to miss it. And people say, oh, you can tell. Look at his mugshot. Everybody could tell that's a perpetrator. Those parents were stupid. And you're like, what?
But also, you don't have any idea who. Because in my case, it's family. In your case, it's a neighbor and a church member. In another friend's case, it was a teacher. It could be anybody with access.
Well, and most people don't think about youths violating children. And look, it was a 2-age gap.
Yeah.
But it was no less traumatic.
But he's also, he went through puberty quicker and had like pubes and curly black hair. And we think my grandma messed around with like the head of the mafia in Palm Springs because he looked nothing like my grandfather. My grandfather used to beat him with golf clubs too. And the inside scoop was he was illegitimate. He was, my grandma cheated. And I think that's where my grandfather's anger towards Chris, he had a fake ID, Christopher Corsini, named after the gentleman that we think my grandmother had an affair with. And he was Italian looking. Where, from all this Irish bloodline, I'm like, right. Where did this guy come from with this black hair? So there was that may have been his issue too of not feeling belonging.
But more than likely, and obviously you can't have this discussion with him, and maybe he doesn't even remember, but he was probably introduced to sexual intimacy at a young age, and he felt that this was the only way to have a relationship. And it may have felt very controlling, but at the same time, that's taught. That's taught behavior. And whether he saw it through pornography or someone in the family acted out upon him. I mean, and there were other elements too, where maybe he felt like a misfit child and so he had to do this. And I know for me, I felt like a misfit when I went back to school. And the only way I thought I could build friendships was through acting out with other kids.
What about raging hormones? And at what point is it just playing nurse?
But what nurse has done that to you?
Thank you.
I don't need to know.
Thank you. No.
But do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's like
no,
when they say,
right.
Oh, we're just playing husband and wife. Oh, I'm sorry, but my kids have not seen my husband and I have sexual intimate relationships. Playing husband and wife to them is cleaning dishes together, making or sitting down and watching TV.
I didn't walk in on my parents until I was 10 or 11, seeing the monster with two backs.
Thank you.
What he was doing to her, I was like, oh my God, no. And they're like, oh, close the door. Okay, get out of here. You know, not like,
see,
do we need to talk to him or anything?
So I'm being traumatized.
Oh, right. Yeah, on the waterbed. It was great. Oh, jeez.
No.
I found my dad's porn. And then my mom found, I took one Playboy from my dad's porn stash and I kind of hid it in all my bookshelves with all of my stuff, but it was like between two things or something. My mom was a neat freak, also Leslie Mesley's, but she'd alternate because of her manic depression. So there'd be times where she'd be going through everything in my room and I'm sitting there going, oh my God, she's close to it. She's oh my God, she's on the same shelf as it. She's looking, what is she looking for? What? And she pulls it out. Keith, what's this? I'm like 12 or 13. I'm like, oh God. I'm like, that's D's. I took it from here. I took it to the drawer. The one next door with the dildo next to the bed and the thing.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But how did you know all that stuff?
Through my uncle, through Playboy, through school kids, which the information from the other school kids that we talked with after school and stuff, totally worthless. They didn't know shit about sex. Zero. They knew nothing about it. A complete disinformation. I kind of knew that at the time. They're full of shit.
Right. But that's because you were being taught all those things by your uncle.
And I was also taught something really fake about these airbrushed girls with all this makeup and this lighting and these clothes. And that's not how people are. That's not sexuality.
Right.
It's a visual.
Well, and that's the challenge, especially now. I mean, you used to be able to look at behaviors of kid and in the change and understand that there must be molestation taking place there. And now there's this whole other element that we don't know if it's actual physical contact. It's, are they being exposed to pornography through the web? And they don't know what to do with the information they're taking in. There's nowhere to turn because, or it could be on cable shows, that sexuality and intimacy is totally out there and kids don't have anywhere to process what they're seeing. And there's a great episode of Law and Order SVU, and this young boy, his dad goes off to work at night, and he gets on the computer and he's watching porn, and then he's arrested for acting out with a younger girl. And they said, well, didn't she yell out no? And he says, yeah, but that's what the lady in the video did, and she liked it. So he's 10, 12 years old, acting out with the 7, 8-year-old girl, and he's trying to duplicate what he's seeing on the internet, but he has no filter that of what he's watching, and he's just trying to duplicate it. And he doesn't even realize and fathom that it's illegal, that she's hurting, that no means no, because there's not an adult helping him process through what he's seeing. And even if a parent's watching television with their kid, what they normally do is they quickly switch the channel as if the child didn't take in that 10-second soundbite. But what that parent needs to do is talk about what that child saw and ask if they have any questions, so they're not going to the playground and getting the misinformation. But the parent is the primary teacher there. If they're treating women with disrespect or men with disrespect or minimalizing something, the parent needs to have that conversation right then and there and not just turn the channel. They need to be the active parent talking through what that child's hearing and seeing, so they become that person to have those conversations with. So if there's anything questionable happening at school with a religious leader, a relative, that they know that parent's ready to have those tough conversations and work through those, so they have a place to turn. I didn't have anywhere to turn. And my niece, you know, mimicked that. Is she said, my mom asked me one night, she said, I asked you every night I put you to bed, did anything bad happen today? What good happened today? And you never mentioned anything. And did he threaten you? And my memory is very skewed in what I remember, because I dissociated so much. I went elsewhere. I didn't necessarily take in the trauma consciously. And I said, well, I don't think he threatened us. And I asked my niece, I said, did he bribe us? Did he threaten us? She said, no, but what would we have said? We had no understanding.
His name's not Keith.
I didn't say Keith.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
What did I say?
I thought I heard.
You got nervous.
Oh, no, I
don't. I don't say his name.
Really? Okay, good.
He's never served a day in jail, so even though I know it's true.
I never hear anything like that. I never hear prosecutions later. People always will be like, later, they're 22, they're 25, they're 30. They talk about it, and they're like, oh, yeah, this happened when I was a kid. But I never hear that. Corey Feldman, when Corey Feldman was on 2020 and he was talking about it, which, good for him, by the way. We're talking about the predators.
Absolutely.
The DVs.
But it disappeared very quickly.
What? Oh, that thing?
Corey.
No, because I'm bringing him on the show.
Oh, good.
He's going to come on January, February or so. And God damn it if we're not going to be able to talk about that, because he was very brave to do that.
Absolutely.
That is, you are gone. You are out of the industry. Nobody wants to deal with you. It's taboo.
And it shouldn't be. The person who's the perpetrator should be the one sentenced, not the victim.
One kid gets helped because somebody comes forward like that, then that's totally worth it.
Absolutely. Well, because that perpetrator hasn't stopped. They are continuing.
I mean, parents need to know how to do it. My mom went and approached me at like 14 about sex. It's like, here, and this goes there, and you wear a condom, and there's AIDS, and it was like 84. And this is how it works. And I took the condom or whatever, and I was like, I will never touch pussy again in my life. I was so scared. And my mom was like, you could tell me anything, and when it happens, let me know and everything. So when it did happen, I was basically raped by like a girl older than me. Like, it was fun. But it was weird playhouse things. She cooked me like a chicken pot pie, put on AC/DC, and then like took me to the couch. And then her parents walked in. I'm like, talk about having more fucking problems. We're like finished and rattled the front door. She's like, oh my God, they're here. So I have this like weird, very weird thing. I feel I can't. And so my friend Sky goes, how did you deal with it? Did you, you know, blossom? Did you like turn in and predator other kids, or did you shut down? And I said, I shut down. I shut down, and it's affected every relationship in my life. I lost my girlfriend of 15 years because of sexual issues too. There's money issues, but she's like, if the money ain't coming, the fucking better be happening. And at that point, I felt pretty shattered because when guys get laid off or, you know, don't have a job or can't be the breadwinner in the home, their role is pretty unclear. I felt used. I felt like a sex object. I felt like I was being objectified. And I couldn't ever possibly identify, you know, the way that women are objectified in this society. But I felt that way. And she just said, you don't have a right to feel that way. You have to be man up and everything like that.
But you can't, I mean, and that's the challenge. And that's a whole nother aspect of what we're trying to do with A Quarter Blue is have people have a healthy understanding that for victims, it's a life sentence. That's reality. And you can work through therapy and all of that. And there are just points in our lives where things are going to butt their ugly heads and we have to work through them again. And it's a constant releasing process. You know, you...
It's been 32 years since the molestation started for me, or 34 years. The show you came on as my first guest is the first time I publicly ever talked about being molested as a child. That was the first time. And even when I approached my mom at like 22 or something like that, that's 10 years. Then maybe at 32, I talked to a girlfriend about it, and here we're at 42. So maybe three times I've ever tried to even look down that fucking dark hole. And but I feel like I've moved on. I've grown up, but I'm like, no, for the rest of my life, that is something that I will carry. Hopefully I process. Hopefully I heal. Hopefully I forgive.
It's a healing process, though. But I want Wayne to tell you just briefly his wife's story and how she remembered and how it unfolded, because it explains how our minds work and protect us, and it's pretty amazing. He's turning on the mic right now, and you're going to hear Wayne's awesome voice. Here, I'll scooch over.
Hello? Is it on? This one's on.
You want
Hi, Wayne. Thanks.
How are you?
I wanted you in here for the show instead of sitting out in the reception area, hanging out. Can you hear okay?
I can't hear, but I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah.
What were we saying, Martha?
Well, share about Meg and her remembering and recalling her abuse.
Meg was a professional musician and a great pianist and vocalist. Did mostly church music. And she was one of those kinds of people that just basically seemed to have everything going for her, and it seemed like her whole life was together. But the thing that we had noticed was that every time she would pass me and I might reach up and touch her, say if I touched her on her bare skin when she was wearing a dress, she hardly ever did. She wore pants most of the time. If I touched her on the knee, and not in a sexual way, not grabbing at her, I could lose my life.
I jumped when my ex-girlfriend would touch me, even on the arm.
She had a visceral response.
I would jolt. I would jump.
It's a body memory.
And that's what she would do. It's all stored up in her body. But she had so successfully hidden this away that and said it's not right for her to remember that, because after all, she's this wonderful, godly human being, you know. And she's not supposed to be remembering that kind of things. And so she successfully hid it away. And again, you know, from 8 to 13 or 14 years old, this was going on in her life. And she, the result of that in our marriage was really telling. It was really hurting our marriage. And so we sent her to therapy. That's what we thought was going to happen, because, I mean, it was the best thing to do, because otherwise it was costing us our marriage. There was just no way I wanted to be married to somebody who responded to me that way every time I touched her.
Or couldn't trust you like that.
And suddenly, and suddenly I'm the perpetrator, and I don't even know what I'm perpetrating. You know, I don't know what she went through. One afternoon, she was playing the piano, and she played a song called the Warrior's Song on the piano, which is very loud and very big and noisy and has this big glissando that goes down into the bass, and the piano just rocks and things. Every time she'd play that, we'd know she was angry at something, and the kids and I would disappear. You know, we're out of the house. And suddenly she stopped in the middle of one of those big long runs, and the piano reverberated. I thought she'd fallen off the piano bench. I went in there to see what was wrong with her, and she was frozen in place on the piano bench. You can see what that does to me.
Wow. Wow.
Everything that had happened to her, she remembered. It came rolling back into her life and into our lives. And what that caused her to do at that point is it dropped her back into her lost adolescence, and she quit coming home. And I knew something was really drastic, something profound was happening in her. There was a lot of profound things happening in our lives at that time. I'd just gone into the field of psychology. I hadn't painted for years, and I took up my art again. And I quit drinking, you know. So there's a lot of stuff going on for me, and suddenly my wife doesn't come home. And she takes up surfing. She gets a tattoo. She starts hanging out with kids. She doesn't come home. She didn't come home all night. And I decided that she was in process, and when the process was over, then I'd determine whether we had a marriage left or not. Mm. And somewhere along the line, she said, I think if you'll stick with me, you'll have better from our marriage than you ever thought possible. And I said, well, I'm not going anyplace. You can't make me go. I will not leave. And I'm going to stay. And we'll see what we have at the end. And I never, ever asked her where she was or what she was doing or who she was with. I simply gave that part up because she began to deal with the fact she was molested as a child. Mm. And for me to add that to her life was ridiculous. And what she taught me out of all of that has really formed the basis for my practice. And if I began to tell stories of the women who come in and boys who come in and tell me what happened to them as children, and that nobody understood and nobody would listen to them, and that, you know, that the whole media thing is we get all upset when somebody steals a child and they find them dismembered up in the mountains someplace, and we think that's what child molestation is about. It's not. It's the neighbor. It's the baseball coach. It's the music teacher at high school or at elementary school. It's the guy across the street. It's the guy who lives in the bedroom with your mother, you know, who's maybe not your dad. That's where it happens, and that's the devastation that it creates. You know, that's why we want to.
I mean, think if it was more of a stranger and someone not in the school or the church or the home, that it would be easier to deal with. But since it's someone close to you that you're supposed to trust, that freezing, that possum-like kind of, if I just play dead, it'll be over soon.
Yes. Right. And it's the dissociation.
Trauma in children creates alters sometimes. So the strong dissociation creates alternate personalities and ways to deal with it. And they use that for a million ways. Integration, I've been working on bipolar, manic depressive, borderline personality. There's a million things going on. But I've learned integration, trying to bring the manic state and the depressive state, those different people that I am at different times and different people I am as an actor too. I'm different to all different people. And many of my characters have those levels of the person they're pretending to be and then the layer behind them. I've noticed a lot of my characters like that. I think that's how all humans are.
And of course, I say we're all wonderfully multiple personality disordered, which is really a kind of a good thing because I think of our emotions as being like small children. They're not rational, not reasonable, or not logical. And if we try to lock them away someplace, we'll be really, really sorry.
Yeah. Let's just take a short break, and we'll be right back in a second. We're good to go? This program is brought to you by nobody. We have no sponsors, no advertisers, and that allows us to talk about this kind of thing. Because if Pepsi or Chevy or Disney was sponsoring this program, my phone would be blowing up. The switchboard would be going off. You shut that down. You can't talk. You're canned. You're fired. We're not sponsoring the show anymore. So we just don't do it. That allows this studio to thrive and tell the truth and talk about things that are taboo on mainstream media. I'm glad you're here. I've had a few great shrinks in my life. One said had a motherectomy. It's like your parents, if they're not following and being good parents, you don't have to be a good son. It's like just move on and grow up and talk to him every once in a while, but you need a motherectomy. And I had one. It was beautiful. Genius. But there's a lot of unresolved shit with my mom. I've been getting over it as I've grown up, but I feel like I've just been stuffing it. And I feel a weird, and my friend Sky was saying, you're going to have a confrontation. You're going to look in the mirror or something's going to pop up. And And it does have episodes every 7 years, my little Saturnian urges. And me and my dad would cycle together. So I'd wind up in, you know, self-commit for a week or so. And he would for that week. This time around, I was rocked with a breakup and all this other crazy stuff and stress and money. And this time I'm handling it much better. I'm coping better. And I talked about earlier about making better choices. At 42, totally. I wanted to own my life a little bit more. And I was like, not be able to blame anybody. Let me be the one to make the decisions. Then I can't have no one else to turn to and go, well, it's their fault. It's my fault. So this time around, I actually handled it well. My father died. The week I'm going through an episode, he dies. But usually we used to sync up and it would be really weird. It would be, they would call, you don't even talk to them. There's no years of contact. And they're like, oh, by the way, Jeff also was found in a gutter this week, miles from home, and, you know, rambling and raving about some Boy Scout poem. Really weird. Mine was like, I would shave my head. That's a big thing for me. When I get all knots, I'll shave my head. I'll try to cut.
It's a cleaning process.
Yeah.
Sure.
And like in Pink Floyd, The Wall, he shaves his eyebrows and his body hair and all this stuff. And for me, it's like a rebirth. It's like get rid of this memory that's in the cortex, the cuticle of this hair. And also a rebirth to pre-puberty, to go back to see and to feel that, you know, before the hair, before you grow into this gorilla, this man. And my mom, I explained that to my mom. She goes, oh, that's good. But this time I handled it a little bit better, you know.
Well, you're choosing a completely different path than your mom.
And my grandfather. My grandfather had a path too.
Well, and I think that's partially what's difficult is because your grandfather was so visible and everybody knew who he was, that you had this burden upon you. And I mean, separate from all the abuse, you were the kid who people admired as an actor. And
it's the same thing as trying to keep face of a regular family where nobody's in the industry. It's the same issue. Got to pretend like you're normal. Deny it, pretend like it didn't happen, and we're a happy family, and we go on and, you know, pretend like it didn't happen. There was a little extra of, like, you can't shame the family. You can't say Jackie Coogan's son molested Jackie Coogan's grandson.
Well, it didn't even matter if putting the word Jackie Coogan in there, because you can't say that about anybody.
But that was hanging over the, I mean, that's hanging over the head. That's hanging
right.
over the family.
That's I mean, it's amplified.
Yeah, a little bit.
A lot of it, but it's everybody's trying to keep the family secret quiet. And the problem is, as long as we're keeping quiet, we're endangering more children.
Yep.
And we're not stopping the cycle of abuse.
And ourselves, because I have moments of self-destructive behavior.
But I don't think it's ironic at all, but I think it's amazing that you're saying this last time you dealt with it better. But that last time, hadn't you just come open about being abused as a kid with me on air?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. You're dealing with things from a more transparent, truthful model. And in that, it's freeing. And there's not as much of a burden to...
It also slipped on like a comfortable silk slipper. I'd always been afraid of that and nervous and afraid of exposing that about myself.
Of course, what do we tell children? We tell them to behave yourself. It's your fault. You did this. What did you do?
We also say it's private. It's a secret special
secret.
Place. This we hide it.
Yeah,
we cover it with clothes.
Absolutely.
We don't show it on TV. We don't. It's something we don't show and talk about.
That's right.
And yet you were conflicted as a child because you were being told to expose it and use it and please someone else through that. It was conflicting because you were knowing how it's supposed to be on television and movies, but your reality was completely the antithesis of that.
By fifth, sixth grade, I knew that whenever I read scripts, I would check to make sure there was no naked bare bottom. Because every once in a while you'd see a script, oh, and he gets pants and he runs off into the woods and you see his butt. And I remember I would never take a part that would show my naked ass. And this is at 14 and 15. I'd already made that decision. No, I'm never going to show that much of myself on screen.
Yeah. Well, that is all stored up in a small part of us. Like I say, it's in a child part of us.
And, I grounded my inner child. He's so grounded.
Yeah.
Now
all we want to do is to embrace that child instead of locking it away And so many times we do that to ourselves. They're not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it. And I'm not going to embrace that part of myself that is so damaged and so hurt.
I had a friend who was an actor who said to me, he's like, you hate your child. You hate your child. And I actually went back to therapy for a session after this time with him because I looked so forward to seeing him. He was someone I adored as a child. And so when he said that, I thought, okay, I will look into that. And the whole ride home, I was actually in Palm Springs. The whole ride home, I was thinking, I love that child. I worked hard to protect her. I went back home. I pulled out pictures of myself when I was little. I said, actually, I really love you. And that's why I fought for you. Now, it wasn't a matter of dissociating to cope and to make it through. And a lot of it was masking things. But it allowed me to survive and ultimately thrive. And I actually love who I was at 7 and 10 and then 13 and all those ages. I truly love that little girl. And I hurt for the times that she hurt and had nowhere to turn, meaning myself. But I look at those pictures and I'm amazed at the beauty and the strength because I made it.
How old were you when you started acting?
4.
So you were never the age you were supposed to be. You were always a couple of years ahead looking back at that younger version because you needed to be more mature to learn the lines and hit the marks and be on time and behave.
But at the same time, I always played younger.
Yeah, me too.
I was an adult.
Me too.
I was in an adult world. I mean, it was an obedient world of high expectations. I think we were both, while we were uniquely children, we were pretty mature. You have to be in the industry.
Yeah, they used to say 8 going on 40.
You can't just play when you feel like it, you know? You have to be attentive. You have to take direction well. And you have to be able to jump into school and complete an assignment in 20 minutes, you know? I mean, it is an amazing adult world where you are mature. And possibly part of that helped us make it through when we were being molested.
Is there similar kind of psychology or association to battered wives, people that have, like as adults, have issues at home and domestic abuse and stuff like that? Is it the same kind of like mechanism for protection when an adult has something like that to themselves?
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's don't tell. Don't let anybody know. Everything that gets in the dark that way gets kind of sick. You know, it really does. And if I'm not going to tell what's happening to me, and I couldn't tell when I was a child, now I can't tell that when I'm being abused as a wife, you know, because if that happens, then I lose my support and my family will abandon me and it's not the way it's supposed to be. And
if they know I'm spoiled or damaged, they won't love me.
Nobody will.
Well, and who's going to believe me? Everybody loves him. Who's going to believe me that this happens behind closed doors? Yeah. I mean, really the dynamics are very similar.
Very, very similar. Very, very similar.
And a lot of times men and women who walk into abusive marital relationships were in an abusive relationship as a child.
Absolutely.
You don't understand what a healthy relationship is. You don't understand what true, unconditional, authentic love is because you haven't truly experienced it. Everything was a mirage and to keep up appearances and to keep a secret. And so anytime you had that sixth sense that something was wacky in your dating relationship or and so often when I've been at trials with people, a crowd shows up in support of the victim and they're like, you know, I never would have said anything, but now that I think back, that guy was kind of too good to be true or something wasn't right. But I just thought, oh, and I feel guilty about being here now because I felt something. And so often in everything, we dismiss our internal voices.
That's right.
That sixth sense. That intuition.
We quit listening to the voice inside of us that tells us what's right, what's really going on, and that we can tell, we can speak about it. There are people who will listen.
It's funny how Modern Family, you know, the young girl, the middle girl on Modern Family is going through the a custody fight. She's staying with her older sister now, but the mom was supposedly abusive, and so she went and got, like...
In real life. Right.
She got temporary custody. You know, the court assigned her to this other person. The other cast members on Modern Family, only after the trial had started and stuff like that, they were like, yeah, the mom was really abusive to her, and it was really awful, and she would say terrible things to her and, you know, smack her with the hairbrush or whatever. And I went, if you were really worried, how come you didn't say anything before this trial came up? How come somebody raised the flag and go, hey, this mom's not right on the set?
Right. Everybody second guesses the what if, what's next. She won't be on the show in that case.
They're probably just scared of that mom. They're like, she'll beat me. I don't know.
Well, they're just afraid of what's going to happen to the family structure. And that's why, you know, we really we're creating this show for parents that will address certain things like that. When you have those suspicions, what are the steps to take? So that it's clearly mapped out. And yes, it is possible that your family will split and take sides with the perpetrator. And that stinks. It should not be that way. Unfortunately, that's reality. But when you know that you're going to be protected, you will be provided for. And we're going to give answers to such of what the victim assistance programs are in place to help you with that. Because it is possible that the family structure will break down, you know, and that's maybe what the cast was thinking is, oh gosh, where's that girl going to turn? You know, will CPS come and pick her up on set? And they overthink it about what the next steps are. And then they keep it quiet because they think by reporting it, it's somehow going to get worse. But what happens to our insides and how it affects our relationships in the future and all that upon that young girl, they should be thinking about that. Protect her now and get her the help and support she needs to move forward so that she'll realize she needs to be loved and respected, and she should not be abused in any manner, so that she establishes healthy relationships in the future because she sees her cast supporting her. Because, you know, being on a show as a child, that's your family. You feel for that year, that 3 years, whatever, that is your family. And how miraculous would it be if your family, as we perceive it as kids, would stand up for us and protect us and provide for us? And instead, unfortunately, so often in Hollywood and in society at large, we're turning our heads because we just don't want to get involved. We don't know what we don't want to be the...
That's different for animals. I'll see a cast go, nope, we will not do this scene because you're hurting that animal. And they'll stand united. No, absolutely not. We drop our foot right there. All right, fine. We'll figure out a way to fake it or whatever. But they didn't do that with this girl on Modern Family. And they didn't do that. I've seen kids get beat for all the... You won't get those shoes you want if you don't get this audition. I'd seen it growing up in auditions and stuff like that. The crazy things. Now, I know the parents are under pressure. They don't work. They're relying on these children to, you know, be the breadwinner. A unique situation for us because being in the industry. And I don't think it's any higher, the ratio. I still think even in Hollywood, it's a quarter blow.
Absolutely. I don't really think because we were kid actors, we were more susceptible to it. Definitely, I stood out in a crowd.
You started acting before the abuse, so there's no causality.
No, I know he saw me.
You're not abused because you're an actor?
No.
Because many kids are abused and they're not actors.
No, and actually, my safe place was on set because I wasn't abused on set. But when I went home to Orange County, and if I weren't at my parents' home and I was at their home, I was being abused. So actually, set was my safe place. That I was working and performing and doing something I loved without being, and I didn't even realize I was being hurt, but being in that place where I just checked out. I was active on set. I was completely there. But when I went to his home, I'd endure certain things and try to elongate different games, like Wayne and I were talking on the drive that we're getting ready for an art exhibit in April. And part of it is installation art of doors. And the backside of the door will tell the backstory of the victim or someone sharing about a victim. And the opposite side will share the breaking through, the breaking free of that, the hope that they've experienced. And I told him, I said, I just bought cues today and billiard balls because how my perpetrator would come up behind me was while we were playing pool. He was quote unquote teaching me how to play pool. But now I know that was for him to come up behind me and gratify himself. And so part of my door includes billiard balls and cues as the backstory.
Wow.
And
mine would have cards and a roulette wheel and a belt for craps and the dice.
Right. And there are things we associate with it. Yeah. Right. And I mean, those were the things what a normal child would do. He implemented in, if you will, our relationship was games, Battleship. I bought Battleship to put on this thing too. And my son's like, yeah, I want to learn how to play that game. And I'm like, oh, okay, I've got to reclaim this game as it was meant to be used, you know, and that it's okay to play. Because for me as a child, the times in which I played, I was abused. I never played for fun.
I know I didn't make my bed or clean my room because that threat that my uncle, he'd say, you're not leaving this room until you clean your bed. And now as an adult, or, you know, make your bed. Now as an adult, I'm like, fuck it, I'm not going to. I've started to recently and really clean up stuff. And now when I come home at the, you know, end of a day and I'm like, oh, this is a nice place to hang out. I don't see the clutter. I could be total hoarder. I mean, it's ridiculous. But I could also, you know, go in those manic depressive states of like cleaning everything up. And it's really, you know, everything's kind of perfect and all the, it's very clean lines and it looks nice. It feels nice, actually. It feels nice to kind of clean it. And that's something I've started to own. I just kind of put that together, maybe a reason why, because I would be tortured and unable to leave the room until I did this chore or did this
thing. Right. And we're amazingly complex.
Molester is the one that is the muscle that's forcing me. And there was, I couldn't. I fought as hard as I could. I screamed, I bit, I scratched, and I was helpless.
Right.
Right. But this is your time in which you're reclaiming certain things, like something that, if someone hasn't experienced this, making your bed is a point of reclaiming. And that's you saying, I'm making my bed for me because I want to. And this feels awesome to be in control and to reclaim this. And I know when I take off the plastic off this Battleship game before I put it on this door, I'm going to play Battleship with my son. Because that game was never intended to be used as a ploy to get close to me and abuse me. It was meant to have fun with someone like my son with innocent play. And so I'm going to sink his battleship and enjoy it. And know there's no strings attached and nothing around the corner to suspect that something's going to happen. And that's part of our healing process, is reclaiming that which was taken from us as something amazing and positive. I can actually eat McDonald's French fries now. It's amazing. And I have to be really careful. But I'm so proud of myself that I can now eat McDonald's French fries. Mm. Because that was the reward.
Weird association. Oh, that was the reward.
It was the reward.
Okay.
They were cold because he'd buy them. Time would elapse. And I'd be eating them. And the part of the purchase and the eating was gone. I didn't know what took place there. We were in the camper. But it makes sense. But I could not eat. I still don't like cold French fries. But I will eat McDonald's French fries, and it's and it
you
feels.
Still don't like cold French fries.
No, can't do them. Just an association.
Hmm.
And why eat them anyways? They're not good for you. So I can justify it.
I didn't say that. I like McDonald's French fries.
Cold or hot?
Cold or hot?
Yeah. No, they have to be hot. But I can eat McDonald's French fries, and that's a huge step for me. And that seems, I mean, for someone who hasn't experienced, you say, oh, just get over it. Move on.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what?
You can't tell people to do that. That, you know, it's like somebody coming into my office and saying, nobody knows how I feel because I'm so stressed or I'm so whatever. And I shouldn't feel this way. And I'm saying to them, gosh, you know, if you don't have any shoes, I'm not going to tell you there's a guy down the street who has no feet. I mean, there's a guy down the street from him that doesn't have any legs, and a guy down the street from him's a quad. I'm saying, you don't have any shoes. Darn. That must feel cold. Your feet hurt. You know, so whatever your thing is, you got to own that. You got to claim it. You got to pull it toward yourself and love that little part of yourself and go out and buy it some French fries with no strings attached. You know, go play Battleship with no strings attached.
Or the pair of shoes for the audition. If the kid doesn't do well, he can get his shoes.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and whether we were in the industry or not, We need to reclaim our childhoods.
Absolutely.
And to reclaim that innocence. It was no one's to steal from us. And we have the power to do that.
It's a violation, and it's evil to its core.
It's funny. It was times when there was no chance for me to work because it would be vacation time, or we'd go to Palm Springs, or it would be summer when they came to stay with us. We'd go visit during the winter, like for 2 or 3 days at a time. There would be there'd be incidences, but during the summer they'd come and stay with us for 3 whole months, and that was. But it's the summer, and so if you didn't have a job during the summer, you're not really doing a job that summer. You know, you wait until the fall and this
right.
new pilot season start or whatever the fall season starts.
Yeah, because during
TV.
The summer, series aren't shooting.
No,
it may be a film.
Features are, and I didn't start features until I was 16.
Right, and I didn't do features.
And so for me, whenever I was not working, I was basically exposed and I could be victimized.
And same with me. Absolutely. And working in the industry is amazing in itself, but it amplifies that experience when you know that you're not working, you're going to be victimized. And so it does become your happy place. And so maybe being in the industry isn't all that that I remember it being, but it was safe. And a lot of people think being on set is not safe for kids. And there are incidences that aren't. Don't get me wrong.
There was always 20 people in the room. You know, we were always surrounded by people on stage.
There was accountability.
Mm-hmm. There was tons of people around.
Rarely were we alone with a teacher. There were times. I only had one creeper teacher. I don't remember anything happening, but I had one that was a creeper, and he was very, very, very strict to the point where he'd lock us in the room. And anytime did not like him.
Let's put you out of control.
So, but that was rare, you know, and it's not like kids in public schools are any safer.
No, my ex-girlfriend said it was a speech therapy class, and they one by one would take them off into this basically a janitor's closet, and they'd set up a little table to do the like testing or whatever.
Right.
And that's where the molestation would happen.
Yeah.
And that's another aspect of what we teach is how, one, to protect children and to protect the reputations of teachers. For accountability's sake, it should never be one-on-one. If it needs to be that, there needs to be a window where a secretary can see straight in and you position the chairs of both so there's constant accountability. When you send a child to the restroom, what schools typically do is they send one other child with the child who has to go to the restroom. What if the child who's walking that one was sexually abused and finds gratification at looking at the naked body? They're looking under the slat of the bathroom stall to fill that need, that sexual addiction. If you send 3 kids, it's less likely to happen. What I used to do if I had kindergarten or that, I'd say 2 kids, they have to go to the bathroom. I said, okay, class, we're all going. And I created accountability. And part of that was out of my sick mind as a child. I was a sex addict at 7, where I couldn't get enough of the naked body. And so we don't know the stories of all those children. And so we need to protect them from everyone and enlighten children about if someone looks under the slat, you need to tell your teacher. Most teachers dismiss it. It's just natural curiosity.
So now, but we're still talking that at 13, 14, you can have your first kiss and you can get to second base by 14, maybe 15 and start to feel somebody up. And like, there's still, I mean, a natural progression and growing up and maturing and enjoying your sexuality and discovering your sexuality. Is it's appropriate with someone, your peers, your own age, right? Or is this something like, wow, where's the line between molestation or acting out and natural, healthy sexual development?
Well, the problem with natural, healthy sexual development is happening at 11, 12, 13. It's happening on the school campuses where girls are doing oral sex with boys and boys are doing what they call finger pops with girls. And they're 11, 12, 13 years old. And, you know, the whole sexual thing is so blown out of proportion. It's all blown out of what is appropriate. When I was a kid, we dated. I'd call up Cheryl and say, "You want to go out?" She'd say, "No, I'm going out with Bob." But Charlene doesn't have anybody to go with. I'd say, "Okay, let's double date." And we would do that. And there was there was such camaraderie between all of us, you know. And you might, you know, quote unquote, cop a feel.
We'll get there. The innocence is there and something might happen later.
But we were 15, 16, 17 years old.
It's ahead of us. It's ahead of us.
Yes.
This isn't something we've already gone through.
Well, and the other thing is, from when we were growing up, there weren't the diseases that these kids are exposed to.
Oh, no. That's right, too.
You know, we didn't have the communicable diseases that are incurable. And these kids do. And so if you start experimenting at 11, 12, 13, you're on a racetrack. It's only going to get faster. It's hard to pull back. And the problem is these kids' lives are in danger with, you know, the venereal diseases that are going around that you can just get from swapping saliva. And
well,
that's
just,
what's
just
scary for these kids.
Just consider chlamydia alone. If a girl gets chlamydia once, a little bit of antibiotics will get rid of it. She gets it twice, she reduces her chances of getting pregnant by half. If she gets it a third time, she can kiss pregnancy goodbye. It'll so scar the fallopian tubes that she will not bear a child. Mm. And it's rampant on the junior high school campuses. Why? What's happening here? Where's the values these kids have? You know,
junior high. I mean, I didn't have sex until I was 16, a sophomore in high school.
My friend's right down here with Child Protective Services, and every night, 13 and 14 year old prostitutes are coming in to possibly be placed somewhere, or possibly getting food or this. They're 13 and prostituting themselves right down the street.
And
what happened to them? To bring them up.
Yeah, that's not just unhealthy sexual stuff on a high school campus or a junior high school campus, in an elementary school campus. That's the result of the abuse that takes place in the home. Who exposed them in the first place? Why did their household become so unsafe?
Why did they leave their household?
That they felt that the street would be safer than being raised by Uncle Charlie or mom's fifth boyfriend.
And sex becomes an act that has no human intimacy. It's a dehumanizing act then. And that's the problem. That's never what sex was intended to be. It was a beautiful, intimate relationship between, you know, a man and a woman to be adored and to put an exclamation mark on how they felt for one another. And now it's hooking up. And it's like...
Yeah, these kids
today... And the problem
today,
is they're endangering their lives.
Yeah, when I hear them talking about their relationships, these relationships are exclusive on the junior high school and elementary school campus. We're going steady. It means we're really not going to go with anybody else. And pretty soon, all they want to do is get by themselves. Because what they're doing by themselves is some kind of sexual thing. And I'm saying, why is that happening? Where's the core values that we live our lives by? You know, we seem to have lost that in what we see in entertainment.
Well, they're developing faster because of the input, because of that stimulation, because of the computer, the television, the satellite. I've seen adult stuff cross into the mainstream. So it'll be on Real Housewives with Beverly Hills, or it'll be on a network TV show. And I'll be like, I can't believe I just saw that. That's
right.
Like pornography.
Right. And every relationship that starts on TV with anybody ends up in bed. Well, after all, we've known each other 20 minutes. Quick.
You know? We're on the couch, we're on the top of the fridge, we're on the hard Spanish tile of the kitchen. Yeah.
Exactly.
In the pool. The water, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, in film and TV, water is the subconscious symbol for the sexual
Yes.
Well, my kids watch a family channel. I won't even say what it is. And like half the time I'm like, what? At what point is this a family show? Why? What? Please turn the channel,
you guys.
I was watching
Doctor Who last night with some friends, and they said, no, it's rated like PG. It's a family show. And Doctor Who can kind of go there sometimes with some weird stuff, but ultimately it is. And it wasn't, the one thing I noticed when I was watching Doctor Who, there wasn't the sexualization that came from it. There was a transition of how any kid involved in the show, it was about a coming of age issue or maturing or learning what it means to be an adult, but it was never sexual. Everything on American television is ridiculously sexual.
Very sexual.
And it's all about, oh my God, he's going to come. He likes me. He doesn't like me. I got to text him. I have to do this for him or else he's not going to like me. I have to sleep with him or he's not going to like me. That pressure. And then it's great to cut to the other side. The guy's like, I don't want to do it. I don't know. But if I don't, I'm not a man. And my friends are going to make fun of me. So I have to do this. So they like field both pressures. And I think it's, I'm pretty sure it's media. I mean, even Us Magazine or People or whatever nowadays you open and it's skirts an inch below the...
But who's on the cover of those magazines?
Mm-hmm. Who?
Teenage moms.
Teenage moms, yeah.
Kids
are having kids.
We don't have bastard
get
children
on that show. They're actually getting pregnant so that they can get on Teen Mom.
I was working with a police officer who... she was working a case and the girl had said that she was obsessed with becoming pregnant. She goes, it's impossible. She wasn't. She's 12 years old. And I said, hold on a minute. And I pulled out the People article. I brought it to the station and I said, read this article. It's talking about how all these teen moms, this show was created so that it was supposed to be, see why you don't want to get pregnant. But now it's like,
they're
you can
on
be
TV
a celebrity.
Because of this. Yes.
If you can, it doesn't matter how dysfunctional you are. The more dysfunctional you are, you can actually become a celebrity that's going to appear on People magazine. I'm in. You're in. Let's go.
There's
and
no
their girls are becoming
press.
Obsessed. Exactly.
Totally obsessed, yeah.
And if you could just lay out a year's subscription of Us and People, you'll see that not actors who are talented are gracing the covers. It's predominantly these teen moms.
Oh, they're cheap. Their reality shows are cheap to do, and the producers are nothing if not exploitive. In fact, I heard there was an episode of Kitchen Nightmares or something, and it was going too smoothly. Like it's going too well. We don't have enough conflict. It's like you have to fight with them and you have to,
right.
It's very like manufactured and it's very, so far from how our lives really are.
Well, and the challenge is people are trying to duplicate that. And we really kind of need to take a step back and say, here are people working through their issues so that they can have a positive impact on the families in which they're going to create, have a positive impact on society at large so we can have a healthier community and we're not ignoring people's mental illnesses, their physical illnesses. Why is cancer on the rise? Why is irritable bowel syndrome on the rise? Why is gun violence on the rise? Why don't we stop for a minute and go to the core issues of why?
And I always get weird about I always get like weirded out on like Christian stuff or Jesus, like that. Oh, to have a healthy family, it has to be Bible and Jesus and like, because I was raised like lapsed Catholic. My mom was like, it's all a con. She went to Our Lady of Malibu, patron saint of surfing and cocaine. Right now I just have this weird feeling that there is a normal. There's a happy and healthy that's not all the way on the other side, you know, Branch Davidian. It's not like weird. I always think of like this cult Christian kind of like, kumbaya. Regardless of religion, that has nothing to do with like just a happy, normal, functioning, communicating family that's supportive of each other. Those are Christian values, but you don't have to be Christian to live that way. And I have to honestly say that what I'm seeing on TV, what I'm seeing on the internet is sinister.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not Luciferian. It's not enlightening. It's not bringing a torch to, this is the truth. These are dark, dark corners.
But we call it enlightened. We're living in an enlightened society where all these things go on. We don't call children that are born out of wedlock illegitimate or bastards. We call them love children. We're going to change the vocabulary.
Right. We're going to open marriage. It's an extended family.
It's all going to be nice. It's all nice. And if we got a whole bunch of people who are saying, and having sex with boys has got to be okay too. You know, wait a minute, hold on a second. You know, where are we going to draw the line in this?
It's like the most common phrase I hear on the high school campus right now is, not to be mean, but.
Right, yeah, not to be mean, but.
And it's the same thing. We're just masking it all. and not seeing that so many people around us are hurting and have no place to turn for that. Right. And be real.
Yeah, what is real? Well, we question that because we're all very zen.
You know? Well, life is a sexually transmitted disease with 100% mortality rate.
Exactly. Totally. 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 And sexuality is a part of life. Yeah. But we need to keep it in proper perspective, I think.
I mean, God really did a number on us. It's like, okay, rub this. Feels pretty good, right? I mean, this is physiology, and this is like rewarding the animal in us to know where to put it and what to use. And that just, oh, because this feels good, all of a sudden, oh, there's a baby. Oh, more, and the man and propagates the species. We're at 7 billion people. Now we have sex without procreation, period, just for the sake of sex. And it feels good. But there's no like completion there. There's no like, that doesn't create something beautiful, you know, perhaps a child. And if it does, oh, it's aborted. Or strap something on there. And I know like 78% of Catholics use birth control, and even the Pope has come down and like, yeah, prophylactic is fine. Abortion, no, but prophylactic is fine. There, it's still a stigma, even though it seems so open in terms of pornography and showing up in mainstream media, kind of crossing that line. Love, sex is a totally mysterious, unknown, hidden act, even to me as an adult, let alone as a child, let alone as me as a child in the 70s. What a child today on their smartphone is more wicked, crazy things than I'd ever been exposed to.
Oh, no.
I had magazines, and I had to wait a month before a new magazine would come out of that kind. At worst, you could get a Penthouse, a Playboy, and a this, a Hustler. That's still, that's only, you know, that's 90 pages or whatever, 120 pages. They could go through 1,000 pages on the internet today.
Exactly.
And tomorrow there's 10,000 more with things they've never seen.
Right.
And 100,000 the day after that. Our brains are being wired differently. They say that our brain has changed from Google and the vast amount of information and language that we're processing now.
Totally.
We're exposed to 20,000 advertising messages a day.
Totally.
And that's the problem. We still are hungering for it. And so just like this beast is just being fed and fed and fed and fed. And so they keep reaching out for more, and they're using kids in that for child pornography. And the images that police find on these computers of these young children are because people have changed their brains where they're sick and they're hungry for these images, and they're just processing them and pulling more and more children into these lifestyles and affecting their lives, their whole entire lives. And we need to get a grip on this. We need to start prosecuting people who are utilizing these images. And we need to not just think, I mean, we're taking freedom to this whole other level. We are in a free country, but freedom was never meant to look like this. And I'm saddened that America has not creating balance. We're just saying, oh, we're free and we have the right to this.
Yes, but when we take that and then we just absolutely infuse that into our culture, we're going to release predators. We're going to release the molester into our world. And they're going to target children who are the helpless. They're the ones we need to protect the most, and they're not being protected.
They're not at all. And nobody's taking responsibility for that. And that's the problem. And as long as we remain silent in that, we're saying it's not our responsibility. You take care of your kid, I'll take care of mine. And the way I take care of my kid is I know everyone that he's around, and I never take my eye off of him at a park. Well, it's not the people at the park who are the problem.
No, it's not the stranger. We talk about stranger danger. Okay. But it's not the stranger.
No, I know exactly what a child molester looks like. That guy in the van with the weird trench coat rubbing his crotch. That's he's dangerous.
Right.
Yeah.
No.
And it's, what is a crying shame is then you get a 5-year-old in your office who you say, what are you thinking right now? And she says to me, I'm thinking I want to suck on your pee-pee.
Whoa.
She's 5. And I'm going, wait a minute, hold it a second, wait a minute, we got to get other adults in here. Come on,
less disturbing if she said, I'm thinking I want to suck on your cock. But to say I'm thinking of sucking on your pee-pee scares me even more because that shows development where she's at, your pee-pee, your poopy, your dinkle, your wee-wee, your...
Right.
Exactly.
Whoa.
And I get the mom in there and I say, what in the heck is going on? Well, she's living with her sixth boyfriend, who is some guy from the Marine Corps that she met in a bar. And I'm saying there's only one way she can know that.
I'm sorry, my mom went through a lot of stepdads and boyfriends, so that's not phasing me.
Yeah, right, right. And she's making...
I basically call whatever stepdad, I'm like, the guy who's fucking my mom.
There you go.
And he would have.
And he would have, yeah. And so, you know, where is she learning this? Where is she getting to become the predator that she's becoming? She's learning it because somebody is showing her videos. They may not even think she's watching. You know, she's supposed to be playing in the floor while he's watching some video.
I mean, they do talk about when they're selling these new iPad minis and these new things, they do talk about parental controls, and you can always do parental controls. These kids will reprogram that fucker faster than you can blink twice.
Well, most people are using them as babysitters.
They have to turn to the kid. Can you help me install this software?
Exactly.
I'll help you. I'll set up a password. No, you're all good. It's in. These kids are going to be able to unlock that in a second.
Well, you go to dinner anywhere and you look at, let's say, a family of four. Mom and dad are on their iPhones and the kids are on their iPads. Nobody's interacting.
I refuse when I'm sitting with a group of people or we're at dinner or whatever, I refuse to pull up my phone. But there's a moment and then after the meal or whatever, and you're waiting for the bill, someone pulls it out. And everybody at the same time goes, oh, I got to check my email too. Yeah. You're with some people right now. Enjoy them. Enjoy their presence. Not this other, this kind of fantasy, this thing we can't have. And it's invisible touch. It's, it is, we have decommoditized. We don't have stuff. We have pictures of stuff on our phones. And that makes us just as happy as having the shoes or the toy or the ball or whatever it is. Oh, it's shiny.
Or the connection with somebody. Somebody wants me. They called me on my phone. They must want me.
Yeah, but it's all sarcasm too. And it's all like...
Totally.
It's all need too. And it's all like, you know, I'm going here. You need to meet me here. Or you need to do this. Or a question of, hey, can you help me out with that? It's never like, you know, just how you doing? It's always like the instant text. This is coming through satellite down instantly. It's got to be urgent. This is technology better than pagers and doctors had. Heart surgeons didn't have stuff like this. Now kids have it for like, what are you doing after school?
Yeah. And then we got kids who are believing that sex is that urgent. It's not that urgent.
To my body, it feels like it's that urgent.
Totally. Totally.
I mean, it does. And, you know, there's that le petit mort. There's that moment of orgasm that
it's not
everything is washed and erased from your brain. All you feel is that pleasure, that endorphin rush and that serotonin gushing through your brain.
But it's not the part that lasts. It's not the part that lasts. I've got a friend of mine. He married his young Filipino sweetheart when she was 15 and he was 19. War was going on. He's getting ready to ship out. And they let him marry. Somebody knew the war was about over. On the night that he married her, at the party, at the dinner, she became ill. And she started running a real high fever. By the time they got to the hotel room, she was so sick that he got scared and he took her to the hospital. And she was diagnosed the next morning with the worst kind of polio you can have. She was absolutely frozen, except for just her jaw muscle. And she lived that way for 42 years. Now, she never washed his back and met him at the door. She never bore him any children, and she never did anything but just greet him when he came home. And he dedicated himself to taking care of her. That's my hero. Wow. That's the kind of guy I want to be to my wife.
Mm. And you were.
Thank you.
The things he would say to his wife were amazing. Meg is an amazing person. One of my favorite Meg lines is, she said, I thought I'd get a rose tattoo, but then it would become a weeping willow, so why would I do that? And Wayne would say, stop talking about my bride that way. I love you, and I never want to hear you talk that way about the woman I love.
Yeah. She was all the time talking about her body. She says, if it wasn't for my pantyhose, my whole body would be in my shoes. I'm saying, you get. I said, you know, I didn't notice that until you just said that. But you're talking about the woman I love. Don't do that. you know. Yeah, she was an incredible female. She really was.
You were incredible together. Being. And you know what? You're incredible.
Oh, but thank you. Gosh, I'll have to come to these things more often.
I'm usually really scared by the people that like to crack into your skull and know you better than you even think you know yourself. But you really do. You put me at ease, and you have obviously this great joy and this love. I mean, you can see it in your eyes.
Totally.
And you're very knowledgeable. And have you guys worked together, or is this how, in terms of the nonprofit, and you came together, how did you find each other? How did you approach each other? How did you guys put this together?
Well, my wife was also a victim, and she had met Martha, and they developed this really, what would you say, incredible instantaneous connection.
Martha, were you out on these wild, crazy nights with her when she was
in her red boots? Yeah,
in her red boots.
Actually, I'm having trouble throwing my red boots away because they remind me of Meg.
And her Audi TT, which she loved that car. I mean, sake, did that girl put that thing on the road? Oh my gosh.
Now we met after, you know, that time when she was really grounded when I met her, and we sat there and talked, and so much of what we talked about, we didn't need to say a thing. We just knew. We were one. And it's really staggering when I was at her memorial and hearing everyone talk about Meg and how long they knew her and their life. And I said to my husband, Gary, I'm like, I can't believe we've only known Meg. And I think it was at that time 2 years. It really blows my mind because I feel like I've known her forever. And, at that time, Wayne was also on my board. When Meg got diagnosed, when they switched her diagnosis to acute leukemia, they stepped down from the board for a bit. We kept you on, but we knew it was happening. And then Wayne came back and after Meg passed on and has been amazingly faithful. He's a great resource in many ways. One, he's an artist, and he leads our art workshops for victims and their parents. And we've had two thus far, and it's really amazing to watch the healing power of art and what people say through their artwork, even though they don't really even understand that it's coming on canvas.
One of the pictures I had drawn of my inner child, this was a part of therapy and stuff, and it was pretty hollow, empty chest, and a very small heart locked away with a padlock and this little chain over it. Wow. It was very weird.
Do you have it?
Probably not.
If you can find it, I want it in my art exhibit.
That's the things that happen in our subconscious that come boiling up, and when it does, it frightens us so that we put a cap on it. Or we go to a coping mechanism that we use so we don't have to think about that stuff. And the art really helps that come out.
Right, it does. It's been amazing. And he's also helped build our base of interns. It's to come. We're in the process of doing so. Hope University is looking at working with us more closely where Wayne teaches. And he has a very full schedule. He would have had a full schedule, but we refer many people to him because it takes a unique psychologist to understand the heart of a victim. And because of his relationship with Meg, he has a unique understanding. And we always want to refer to someone who understands the heart of a victim and doesn't try to psychobabble us, because we're already not to trust someone in a position of authority. And so we just need them to chill and listen and not think we're whacked and overanalyze us, to just let it come. And so I refer people to him all the time. And I'm thankful to have him, and would love to have, you know, more therapists that have a heart such as his and an understanding. But we work very closely together. And when I say, I mean, I love him as a person, as a professional, and he knows I constantly turn to him and am thankful for him to not only have a friend, but a professional to work through this. And on our drive today, you know, we're talking about what will a podcast look like for A Cord of Blue to reach out. And it's, I think Wayne and I came even closer after Meg passed away, because even after Wayne read my autobiography, and I forget what notes he put on there, but he's like, said something about, I need to see more of you or something like that. It was very standoff. He stood back and was very cautious in what he said. And I said, Meg, what's Wayne really trying to say? She goes, well, give it back to him and tell him you want really his honest opinion. He could just write what he wants. And it was funny because Wayne held back in kind of spilling it all out, probably out of respect. And after Meg passed, it's just all out there. And he's definitely an extension of Meg. And while I miss her incredibly, like I know he does, she's still very present in him and carries her legacy amazingly. There's not enough I could say about Wayne and what he's done for A Quarter Blue and the people who benefit from our work.
We're getting ready to do some support groups, and we're training some people to come in and do that work, do some group work. My practice, there's 19 in the practice. We see about 500 people a week in the practice. And not me personally, thank you, but all of us together, you know. So we're training some people who will come in and run some of these groups. And I want to kind of hang on to the art thing because I find that so, that's such a blessing to me to create and to be with people who are discovering their own creativity. Most of these people don't know they can do anything creative at all.
Honestly, it can be very destructive to like shut down and to go internal and not to have anybody to talk to. So to be able to create product, to be able to create, as we call around here, art. It's a product. It's a product, which is great because it's a great term. It's a math term. It's a product. It's right. Something that you come together.
But what I love about it is we're going to release that small child who nobody has told yet. You know, we're going to get to that place where you said nobody's told them don't talk.
You blow me away, but I really appreciate that hearing that this was like a five-year-old girl because I didn't talk to anybody until I was like 27, I think, was one of the first shrinks I really sat down with. And I'm sorry, I used the term shrink.
I tell everybody that's what I am.
But head shrinker just means like, you know what? A lot of people have these issues and this is kind of what it means and this happens and this is how you move forward. And it does, it shrinks your problems. It shrinks your anxiety. It shrinks the worry that you're so weird and alien to everybody else and so can't share yourself. And you made me feel so at ease. You made me, every time you said something, it made me like smile. It made me actually like happy, not judgmental of myself. And that's pretty rare in terms of support. And so I wish you guys unbelievable, you know, luck and success and keep that going. Keep the seminars going. Keep the art seminars going. Those, you said there was a, you know, big breakthrough with the art seminars and with working with the parents. And I think that's a really good idea to focus on because there's multiple children in the household, then the parents will have the tools and the knowledge to be able to protect the other children before it's too late.
Right. And in our parent support group, you know, we've watched a lot of amazing growth in our families that they've come together. They're restoring their relationships. And in that, their kids are feeling safer. And so we're creating safe homes as these parents and children heal. And as you know, as we've talked, you know, part of the difficulty is working through our childhood traumas with our parents who maybe haven't totally talked to us about them. Or finally, approximately 2 years ago, my mom said, did I ever say sorry to you? And I said, no, you didn't. She says, well, I'm sorry. But I was open about my abuse for nearly 20 years before I heard that. And we want to heal those relationships now. Where some of our kids are 10 in our group, and we want those relationships to be restored now.
We have just 30 seconds left. What's the website for the organization?
aquarterblue.org.
aquarterblue.org.
Correct.
Really great work. Very brave of you, not only to seek help yourself, but also to try to help other people. And thank you, Wayne, for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith.
Very good to have you guys on. Thanks for listening to The Call Sheet.
Thank you, Jeremy, for opening your doors.
I'm Keith Coogan. This show's more Hollywood than you even know, but it's also no different than real life. We're regular people. And happy new year. Love each other. And have a great 2013. Thanks for tuning in. Good night.